acquisition number 12503, Reel 1.
Mr. Lang, Reel 1. Whereabouts were you born, please?
I was born in Calcutta.
And that was because you come from a service family?
No, my father was in the Indian Civil Service. He was Australian-born, a Scottish grandfather, who'd emigrated in the early 19th century from Selkirk. And his family returned to the United Kingdom, and he went to Clifton College and entered the Indian Civil Service with a scholarship to Cambridge Classical College, and entered the Indian Civil Service, from which he retired in 1922 to Scotland, near our family hometown. And I followed the sort of traditional middle-class upbringing of the age. I went to a Scottish preparatory school, and then entered the Royal Naval College, Dartmouth, in the late 1930s, which I left in 1934, went to sea.
What did you think of the course at Dartmouth in the late 30s?
I absolutely loved it. It was pretty rough, and the fact that you had no time to yourself. And the work was very stereotyped, the academic work, a large preponderance of mathematics and science. But I enjoyed the boat work and the seamanship, and particularly the games. I wasn't very good at games, but for my size, I was quite successful at rugby football, although I never aspired quite to the first 15.
So I interrupted you with you telling me what happened after Dartmouth.
After Dartmouth, we went to the training ship Frobisher for 8 months, which was absolute bliss. Two cruises, the first one to Northern Europe, that's Northern Britain, and then Scandinavia, and the second cruise to the Mediterranean. We really did enjoy this. You were sailors, and you felt very important, scrubbing decks and such like. It was academic work too, to the fact that it was all professional work, you know, navigation, seamanship, engineering training, which I particularly enjoyed. And of course, you saw an awful lot of places and were well entertained. We had a trip up to Jerusalem in November 1934, a long, hot day in a bus going from Haifa to Jerusalem via some of the holy places. And we were accommodated in a hospice. And that after supper, or rather at supper, we were supplied with liquid in decanters. It was slightly coloured, and we all thought this was sort of lemon squash or something like that. Very thirsty, poured it out, several glasses. For some unknown reason, sort of a warning tickled in the back of my mind. However, we completed our meal and went round the town of Jerusalem, sort of packs of twos or threes. And about an hour later, the whole that end of Jerusalem was full of drunken cadets holding on to lampposts and such like.
What was it?
It was some form of local, I think, I suppose, Greek wine. And nobody had warned them about it, because the average age was 17 to 17 and a half.
Was this HMS Frobisher?
HMS Frobisher, yes. And so, as I say, that we'd only had a very little, my friends and I, at our table, but by accident more than anything else. And we spent the next half an hour marching cadets in between us and putting them to bed. And a very great personal friend of mine was absolutely out for his count. And I was holding a basin of water while another friend wiped this poor chap's face. He was a devout Roman Catholic. And I dropped the basin on his face. I don't think he ever forgave me for his black eye he had next morning.
So Which year was this that you visited?
This is November 1934, yes.
34,
yes. And when we got back on board, we've all fallen in on the quarterdeck. There must have been some, about nearly 40 of us. It was the Dartmouth, the ex-Dartmouth entry, as opposed to the ex-public school entry. And the captain addressed us and told us how badly we behaved. But it wasn't really our fault at all.
So you did that period of months on the Frobisher, in the Frobisher. And then after that?
After that, we were appointed all in little dribs and drabs. There were five in my lot. We went to the renowned battle cruiser based on Sheerness in the Home Fleet. And very soon after sailing for the spring cruise, we joined up with the Mighty Hood. There were always two ships at sea in the battle cruiser squadron, and the third one, which is Repulse, refitting. But on the way out to Jib for our part of the exercises, spring exercises, we joined up, as I say, we had joined up with Hood off Portsmouth, and we're going down the Portuguese coast with an exercise which involved the two ships at about 12 to 10 miles apart for gunnery inclination tests. That's assessing the angle to the line of sight for the gunners. There were no radar in those days, so they'd know how much to allow for the movement of the enemy ship. And at the end of the exercise, about lunchtime, the two ships were instructed to close by the admiral who was flying his flag in Hood. And we proceeded to close, and it was, as I say, just about lunchtime, and I was the assistant midshipman of the watch. Too young and green to have the charge of all the log keeping, etc., myself. And I remember that the two ships got closer and closer and closer, and as we were forming up, the captain was on the bridge with the navigating officer, and his anxiety was very clear in his voice, saying, "Navigating officer, we're getting very close." And the navigating officer said, "Oh, yes, it's quite all right, sir. The Hood will turn to the course, and we will form up astern of her." And, of course, what didn't happen was that the Hood didn't turn to the course for Gibraltar. We carried on, and the two ships bumped our bow into her stern. And I remember being in the lunch hour, watching, or first of all, I feeling the effect of the engines in the Renown going full speed astern, emergency full speed astern, and the whole mast absolutely shaking with the vibration. And on the forecastle below, which of course was the lunch hour, all the sailors were mustering. And of course, a lot of the sailors had been to the what we call the heads, the toilets, which were always in the fore part of the ship, and they had been in Nelson's time. And you could see them all piling up the ladder from the forecastle as all this was going on, particularly the bump, pulling their trousers up.
So this was 35 when the collision?
This is 35, yes, sir. And we got out to Gibraltar, and we had a hole in our bows, and Hood had quite a bump in her stern. And, of course, there was all the court-martial in Portsmouth later on. And they found my captain, who was really rather dear, guilty, which we thought was rather bad luck. In fact, their lordship squashed the finding and found everybody guilty, from the admiral to the captain of the Hood to our captain, too. And the whole thing had arisen over to a private arrangement made between the two navigating officers regarding the handling of the ship at a lunchtime meeting before we sailed from Portsmouth.
Any other memories from serving in the Renown?
I remember in Hood, which we went to later on, the Spanish War of Independence had started.
Civil War.
And we were at sea. There was some alarm. I think a British ship had been pestered by some Spanish warship of sort. and we sighted the Italian fleet escorting a convoy towards Spain, and my captain making very scathing remarks. I also,
what kind of scathing remarks?
Well, sort of pretty anti-Spanish war. I don't know what side he was on. I didn't really know myself which side I would have taken. We didn't really think much about those sort of things. I was sent off in a sea boat out in the Straits of Gibraltar one day to go alongside a Gibraltar trawler that had been pestered by some Spanish warship, and just to talk to them, find out if they were all right.
You were still a midshipman?
I was a midshipman then, yes.
How did serving on the Hood compare with their renown? Were they much the same? Or?
No. The Hood was really absolutely first class. We were given an enormous amount of responsibility as senior midshipmen, you know, second year midshipmen. We kept watch in harbour on our own in the dog watches. That sounds more than it, that is more than it sounds, because a very big ship like that, you had a lot of routine and emergencies to run, and somebody wanted to see somebody or wanted a special boat or something had to be got ashore quickly. It meant you had to sort of stand up to quite a lot of pressure from senior officers who wanted special arrangements made for them, which the ship couldn't provide the services. But we were very well supported by the commander, a superb man called David Orr Ewing, who could drink beer standing on his head, which is quite an achievement. The captain was Captain Pridham, who was the most remarkable ship handler. And I was his doggy, as they were called, I think aide-de-camp officially, that I meant to sort of help him, sort of anything running a message, manoeuvring, going alongside. I had to watch the transits on the wharf, you know whether we were moving ahead or astern. And I learned a tremendous amount of ship handling from him during that time, which stand me in good stead when I had to drive my own ship, albeit a very much smaller one, some 20 years later.
How long do you serve in the Hood?
It'll be about a year. My little group of five midshipmen, we all got first-class certificates in passing seamanship for the rank of lieutenant, which I think says a lot for the standard of training in that ship. Now, you asked about renown. Well, renown, we were very suppressed. In the old traditional form of midshipman, is to be seen and not heard, you know, this lowest form of animal life.
So that must have been 36 when you were in the Hood, if it was the Spanish Civil War.
Yes,
or into
37, 36, yes.
And then after that?
After that, we went to Greenwich for an educational course. This had been, until then, a two-term course, you know, 8 months. But due to the war being on the horizon, it was cut down to one term. We had the summer term of 37, would it have been, or 36? 34, 35, 37, I think it had been, yes, sir. And you had on the sort of history, English, French, and then mathematics, chemistry, applied mechanics, and a war course, when you learned how to plan operations and all that sort of thing. And of course, the great joy of being at Greenwich was that you were within 20 minutes of Charing Cross Station. But however, all leave expired at 11 o'clock. However, railings where you could climb over.
At what stage did you realize that a war was coming?
I think it was the background, really, right up to well, it sort of got more and more evident as life went on, really. And of course, particularly in, gosh, I've done very bad dates, 39, in 38, and I was married in 39, and I remember we were in Portsmouth. I'd just started my observance course, and you could see all the posters. We used to read the posters coming back from the signal school in the afternoon. Or even you'd see in Portsmouth Harbour train ferries coming in. You know, train ferries didn't normally come into Portsmouth Harbour. They came in, of course, to be refitted as mine layers and that sort of thing, and you knew things were hotting up. Yes, and, oh yes, I forgot to mention the 38 mobilisation of the fleet when I was serving in the destroyer Viscount, and which ran as a tender for the 6th submarine flotilla based on Portland. And we made a visit to Cardiff that autumn, I think, yes. And there was a lot of entertainment from the citizens of Cardiff and Penarth. And I came back on board one night very late, about midnight, having had quite a party. The quartermaster met me on the gangway to say the captain wanted to see me immediately. And so I wondered, what have I done now? And there he was, sitting up, still up in his uniform, to say that a signal had come through that we were to report immediately to Chatham, which was our home manning base, to embark our full crew of reservists. And we were also to take some submarine torpedoes from the depot ship, which was on the cruise with us. Darling, what is the name of the depot ship that we went to? Titania. Oh, yes. Titania. In order to get, you know, transport these torpedoes to Chatham for the submarines there. And we set sail at about 5:30 in the morning from Cardiff, having had a pretty good run ashore the night before. And I remember the captain very kindly saying to me, would you like to take a pilot? I was a navigating officer, you see, which HM ships didn't take pilots in home water unless you particularly wanted to, and of course you had to pay for them. But I said, oh yes, please, and it was quite a help, you know, to have a professional who really knew all the landmarks and things coming out of the Cardiff Basin.
How did you like serving in a V&W class destroyer?
It was marvellous. They were super ships, particularly the Viscount, which was one of two Thornycrofts built at that time of the V&W class. Tremendous power. And we went 25 knots all the way to Chatham, having cruised around at 14 maximum. Even that meant sort of cheating the figures. You weren't allowed to exceed economical speed without very special reasons.
With what attitude did you view the approaching war? With one of dismay or excitement?
Excitement, I think. Certain amount of apprehension, because I was about to take my a wife unto myself. The first hurdle to be cleared was to get my promotion to lieutenant, which arrived a few weeks before. And the second one was, you know, the tremendous amount of work that's entailed in getting her ready for sea. Because of running in a 2/5 complement, the guns were all sort of corked up. In fact, after the September crisis, we took the Viscount round Plymouth to be refitted into a VWL, you know, for the modern anti-aircraft guns and things, and we took over the Achates, the first of the sort of post-war batch of destroyers.
What were you doing when war was actually declared?
I just started my observer's course. I left the Achates and we started up at Portsmouth at the Signal School, doing AWT, and who did a lot of fleet signals and maneuvers. In those days, we still thought of two lines of battleships approaching each other, and even though the Germans didn't have all this number of battleships, it was still taut. And so we had to know also what manoeuvres would be carried out in different situations.
Was much attention paid to the air?
Well, that's an interesting question, because while we were at the gunnery school, it was where we were accommodated, both at the signal school and at the gunnery school, we were sort of told, just before war was declared, that they expected our course to be disbanded and we'd all go back to general service, which was the sort of attitude, really, of the non-flying fleet.
Then what happened to you once war had broken out?
Well, we just carried on. And war was carried, actually broke out, the day that I think we transferred from the shore-based, the non-flying aspect of training, remember the ground training, mostly in air WT, you know, wireless. We had both had to learn the Morse code and work up the standard air set and make deal with all the snags, as well as all the details of fleet maneuvers and such like. And I was actually on leave for that weekend when, you know, the phony air warning came out.
The false alarm.
False alarm. And we went, I think that weekend, we went over to Ford to start the flying training.
Can you tell me about that and
yes.
what you thought of it?
It was really, we thoroughly enjoyed ourselves. There were 11 RN lieutenants, which I was one flying officer, RAF, from Coastal Command, who was flying Ansons, and of course I should think about 20 or so direct entry short service air branch officers. And we flew walruses, one or two swordfish. I can't remember the name of the aircraft. I probably will before we're finished. This is when you get in your late 70s, things, you've got names on your lips, but you can't think. But it was the Thales swordfish, built by Blackburn. And you do use most of it was this navigation exercises. If the weather was very bad, you flew over land and pretended you were at sea. If there was sea, you flew over the channel so that you were able to drop smoke floats and things for drifts and all that. And it was during that course, I was flying in a in a walrus, that's right, and a duck flew into the oil tank and we force landed in the channel. I was actually the wireless operator that day, the air gunner, as he was normally called, having to make out an emergency signal there. But being a flying boat, how we landed safely in quite a quiet sea. And it was very, very misty, and out of the mist we could hear the sound of oars. And then the Bognor Flying Fire Brigade wanted to know if we needed a tow. it was really a sort of Soviet on board. Between there were two lieutenants, and I think the pilot was an RAF pilot officer, not even a sergeant pilot, something. So although he was technically in command as we were under training, we decided that this was an unnecessary expense for their lordships to pay the salvage, and we waited for the air sea rescue to tow us in. The air sea rescue found us very quickly, but the visibility couldn't have been more than a few hundred yards.
What did you think of machines like the walrus and the swordfish?
Well, of course, I didn't know an awful lot about machines in general. I had an elder brother who was in the Auxiliary Air Force, who was fearfully enthusiastic, but then he didn't fly anything very much better. I think demons and that sort of thing. I later on, when I've actually fought in the swordfish, they could be exasperatingly slow at times. They were incredibly robust. I mean, as I say, that this friend of mine who had 179 bullet holes in his aeroplane and still flew.
This was, he got those in the
Bismarck action, yes.
Now, that course lasted about a year then, did it?
No, I think, let's see, we started in the autumn, we finished in February. And then we were all appointed to different squadrons and carriers. I was appointed to join 810 Squadron in Ark Royal, which had just come back from her South Atlantic sweep and the Admiral Graf Spee.
Can you tell me about the squadron, about its makeup in personnel and what?
It was a 12 aircraft squadron commanded by a Major Skeen, who unfortunately was killed later on in the war. I think it was an all-naval squadron. Some of the pilots had only recently changed light blue uniforms for dark blue uniforms, and there were quite a lot of RAF personnel still serving in the squadron. A lot of RN lieutenants, when I said I think at least 50% of the observers were RN lieutenants, and the rest were short service air branch officers. My pilot was actually Lieutenant Cumston, I think, who later became a vice admiral. And he was ex-RAF and had had the distinction of keeping watch in the Courageous, wearing RAF uniform with a naval sword belt and a telescope under his arm. That's a story, but I'm prepared to believe it. A most charming man. Couldn't think of, yes, we got on very well together. Unfortunately, we were separated by accident, really, in during the Norwegian campaign, when he was sent in to fly a swordfish on floats into the British base in Norway. I can't remember which one it was, and came back in a troop ship, which was bombed, and he finished up in hospital, having been very badly cut. Being rescued from the sinking ship. I can't remember which one it was. It was a Polish liner.
So the squadron was equipped with 12 swordfish?
12 swordfish, yes.
And life in the Ark Royal?
Very pleasant, very gentlemanly. I think RN lieutenants kept watch on the bridge. There were 22 people with watchkeeping certificates, and you had to jolly well remember when you were next on watch. That's when you weren't flying or had a flying commitment. Sometimes about once every 2 days you kept a 2-hour watch. But there was massive talent on the bridge. There was a chap called the Air Defence Officer, and of course the captain was frequently there during operations and things. You just really did what you were told and handled the ship when they gave the orders down the voice pipe and things.
What were relations like between the fleet RM and the rest of the Navy on board?
Well, this is a thing that's always worried me a bit. It was started by the fleet RM when the non-flyers were called fish heads. And there was, I think it's because when the fighting actually started, the fleet RM were rather in the front line and the others weren't. And, there was quite a bit of feeling, which was unfortunate because we had